This is RCFB Talk 29. My name is Bob Aghayeri, and I'm joined always by JD and Sirius. And we are here to talk NFL draft with our guest, Jeff Schwartz. And we're happy to have him. I mean, if you haven't followed him on Twitter, we recommend it. He's a former Oregon Duck. Well, he currently is still an Oregon Duck, but he played for Oregon. 8 years in the NFL. He's an author and an analyst in both NFL and college football. He hosts a show on SiriusXM on Pac-12 football. He commentates for Fox Sports. And, you know, he does so many things. It's actually really fun. I recommend, I don't want to, like, belabor this, but dig into his biography. It's absolutely fascinating. And it's really neat that the book he wrote with your brother. I just want to say that. I thought that was a really, really neat idea.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. So it was fun to do. It's been a while now. It's been, oh boy, like we did that in 2016. So it's been 6 years now.
And it's a lot of work to write a book. So, I mean, that's great. And thank you for joining us. I know JD and Sirius have some more substantive questions heading in the draft, but I just wanted to ask, how are you doing these days?
I am good, man. I am getting ready for the draft, obviously, and then kind of, you know, we have a little bit of a slowdown period in sports, and really just in football more than anything else. And so I've got some fun projects coming up, but I'm ready for Thursday. It feels like it's a draft where there's not a lot of excitement, but there's a lot of really good players. And, you know, the draft kind of feels like, to me, it's a culmination of this sort of football season, right? We have, you know, the college football season and into the draft, and you kind of prepare for the next season. So this feels like finally the culmination of this kind of 2021 season.
Jeff, we're really excited to have you on, and I'm very excited to talk about some of the analysis that's going to be going on. But my first and foremost question has got to be this Thursday, what are your plans for the draft? Are you going to be down in Vegas? You holding down in the studio? What's your plans on Thursday night?
Yeah, you know, I don't actually, I have been doing coverage for the previous years. We had a big show last year on Fox Digital. We don't have that this year because, you know, we did the Big Boys Club, for season two. And so we did a lot of time and energy spent on that. But I'll actually be in Dallas. I'm in Portland now for an event tomorrow. And I live in Charlotte, so I kind of have to fly to Dallas and then back to Charlotte. But my buddy Duke Manyweather, who, trains all the offensive linemen, he has an event. So I got my Pac-12 radio show right before the draft, and then I'm going to hop over to the bar, the brewery, actually, and watch the draft. It'll be the first time I've probably been able to watch the draft without working the draft in quite a few years now. So it'll be fun just to kind of sit in a brewery and enjoy my draft night.
That is awesome. I love the fact that you're going to be able to actually sit back, take down a couple cold ones, and enjoy it as a fan and be able to just kind of watch. I know you've been so involved with your Big Boys Club, with all these guys who are going to be going off and getting their NFL dreams finally taken care of, and you're going to be able to sit back and relax. Love hearing that for you. And, you know, I'm really excited to hear, you know, not just some of your guys who are in your Big Boys Club, but all of the guys who are going into the draft. What's your first initial look? I know that you said, we're not seeing a whole lot of excitement. We know that there isn't necessarily like a number one quarterback or a game changing or franchise changing number one draft pick that everybody is clamoring for. But there's a lot of really, really solid players who are going to have a really big impact on the NFL in this season. What's your overall expectation going into this draft?
I guess the expectation is maybe unexpected, right? Because if you look at the top of the draft, right? Normally by now we have a general idea of who it might be, and it does feel like it's trending toward Walker from Georgia. But then, after that, it's probably Hutchinson, and then it's anyone's game, right? Houston can go offensive line, they can go, defensive end, they can go cornerback. The Jets at four can. I imagine they want to go defense and then maybe wide receiver at 10. The Giants have 5 and 7. So how do they handle those picks? And Carolina at 6, right? Are they going quarterback? Are they going offensive lineman? And there's just a lot of unknown because I think a lot of players are going to be equally graded in this draft. Right? There's no one that you, I think, trade up for, right? And a lot of drafts, there's guys that you kind of feel you have to go get, especially quarterback position. even other positions, there doesn't feel like there's a guy. You know, people have mocked, you know, Jameson Williams to Kansas City. They trade up for Jameson Williams. Okay, but that's because they have two picks, right? And they need a wide receiver badly. But there's not a lot of teams, I think, that are going to trade up to vigorously grab someone. So to me, it's like, what isn't normal, right? We kind of feel like I have a good sense of what picks 1 through 10 will be. Maybe there's a combination of about 11 or 12 players that I think could be there. So what's going to be different? Like, what's going to be the wrench and kind of the plan? And so I'm curious to see what that's going to be.
Jeff, looking at the college football season this past year, it seems like we saw a lot of teams that maybe had some more depth than usual, especially teams that aren't necessarily the blue bloods, probably because guys decided to come back and stay for that free COVID year that they got with their extra, you know, kind of like a semi-redshirt status. Do you see that that's going to have an impact on the draft this year in terms of, you know, maybe there's a little bit more variability just because guys had more time to build up tape. Maybe it's a little bit deeper, not necessarily in terms of those surefire top picks, but just really solid guys who could go anywhere, you know, say like a 10-20 range spread in terms of their pick.
It's a good question. You know, there's more guys in this draft than there was last year, obviously, right? And there are guys that came back. I mean, Kenny Pickett's a guy, right? Came back and really improved his draft stock just by coming back one more year. I'm sure there's other guys not off the top of my head I can think of that, you know, were able to come back for one more year and improve where they would be. And so I'm not sure that older players mean they're better players. I mean, they're more mature, I'd say, but you know, if you have the ability to draft a 21-year-old who's kind of just as good as a 23-year-old, you're probably taking a younger kid. So I think that it definitely did change the college football season. It changed it in an interesting way, just personally. Like, I obviously study offensive line. I helped with the Joe Moore Award. Like, offensive lines this year weren't as good, especially at schools that you would expect. And part of that is pro attrition, right? You look at Notre Dame, Oklahoma, Alabama. You know, they had a bunch of guys go to the NFL over the years. Oregon as well, out west. And, you know, teams with even older players that came back, you thought like, oh man, that offensive line would be really good. They just weren't. And I wonder if sometimes it's better to have the young guys start to play and kind of get their feet wet and add, you know, new talent basically to your team. And if you're a fifth year senior or sixth year senior playing, you're probably just good enough for college, right? Like, you're not many of those guys are being drafted. If you're ready to play now, you're getting drafted after year three or after year four. So the depth was there in college football. I don't know if it made it better this year, right? Like, I just think there are a lot of guys that probably would not be on the rosters. And we know that coaches always defer to playing older players, right? That's something that, you know, they love, you know, older players and veterans and guys that know what they're doing. So I don't know if it ended up being a good thing. And for the draft, I'm not sure it matters much other than there are guys that certainly came back and their draft stock went up because they had good senior seasons.
Yeah, I think that definitely kind of tracks with, you know, if anybody has followed Alabama in the slightest, watching their performance against Georgia especially and just their inability to run the ball like we've been used to Alabama being able to do, and they just couldn't really get that going with, you know, kind of the smash mouth football that really got the whole dynasty started. And it was a little bit shocking to see. So really interesting to think about the perspective of those older players.
It certainly is. It was surprising. It's why I liked it's why I liked Georgia to win the title game. I just thought that the SEC championship game was kind of an aberration. Like, it's not really how Alabama's offensive line played all season. I do think that attrition, look, I mean, how many years in a row now has Alabama had a first-round offensive lineman, right? It was Jedrick Wills, it's Alex Leatherwood, it's going to be Evan Neal now. Like, eventually, you just kind of run out of those dudes. It's not like Nick Saban's fault. I mean, Oklahoma has the same problem. Notre Dame had the same problem. You just eventually can't replace these guys. And I think that's what happened last season.
You know, Jeff, you bring up offensive linemen, and that, of course, is your specialty in being able to evaluate that on film and take a really good analysis of the guys who are going to be able to make it next in the league. I'm really curious, out of the top guys that we're going to see, likely top 10, definitely top 20, you got your Evan Neals, your Charles Crosses, yeah, your Akeem Okwonu's out of North Carolina State, your Trevor Penning's out of Northern Iowa. when you're looking at this crop of offensive linemen, what is the thing that stands out most to you?
I think there's just a lot of depth. You know, you're not getting the guys, you know, Penei Sewell, Rashawn Slater, probably. I mean, Evan Neal and Ikey are probably close, but to me, it's about depth. There's just a lot of depth in this class. You could probably get yourself a good guard or center in the second round. I mean, look, Tyler Lindenbaum, Iowa's center, really no fault of his own, might be in the second round. Like, that's an incredible steal. He's one of the best offensive linemen in this draft, but just because of the nature of the way the draft works and where the value's at and who's drafting where, you know, you might get him in the second round. There might be a situation where one of the guards, Green or Zion, drops the second round just because of the way the draft unfolds with wide receivers and defensive ends. Like, it's going to be a draft where you're able to get, I think, a lot of quality starters in the middle rounds as far as offensive line. But again, I mean, you're going to have four guys, probably the four tackles go before pick 16. And then you'll have, I think, one or two guards will go. Maybe, you know, Tyler Smith or Raymond will sneak in the first round as another tackle. And then Linderbaum, as I mentioned, has a first round grade, probably not going in the first round just because of positional value.
You mentioned the value that you can get in this year's draft in a second round or a later round. Do you think that we're going to see a bunch of trade down trades this year when it comes to terms of picks? I know that we won't necessarily see any kind of trade up where someone's going to go, hey, I absolutely need this guy with a third overall pick, so I'm going to mortgage the future farm against that. But is there enough of a market, you think, that we're going to see somebody go, hey, I want to get as many second round and third round guys as I can out of this year's draft just simply because of the depth?
I think teams desperately want to trade down. Like, but the problem is, who's trading up, right? So, like, Carolina at six, I mean, they would love nothing more than trading down. But who is going to trade up, right? Because Carolina has no picks in the second and third round. So you have to remember that that's part of the process too, right? Is you have to be able to have a partner to move. And I don't know who's trading up to six. I mean, who are you trading up to six to get? Offensive tackle? Are you giving up a first-round pick next year? Are you trading up for Kenny Pickett or Malik Willis? Like, I just don't see that happening. So I think that's part of why this is so tough, is that there are teams that desperately would love to trade down, but who's trading up? Like, who wants to go up and get someone is the big question. So that, to me, is, again, it's a big part of this draft where there's not a lot of guys. I think teams are going to be like, hey, man, I just got to have this guy.
Well, I know that you do say that, but you also just mentioned two really interesting names for this draft with Malik Willis and with Kenny Pickett. We know that a quarterback is always going to be one of the most fundamental, game-changing position players that you can possibly draft or even pick up for your franchise.
Yeah.
Do we think that there might even be a team desperate enough to say, I need to be able to get a quarterback, whether that's somewhere around the 14th, 15th pick, and they see that all these quarterbacks are still on the board? Would that might be an opportunity that someone can finally cash in on that trade down?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you get to, like, pick, you know, New Orleans at 16, Chargers at 17, and you really like Malik Willis, and you have intel that Pittsburgh seems to be on him, that seems to be the rumors. Of course, look, these are all just rumors and smoke screens, and we don't really know what's real in the end, but there's a lot of talk about Malik Willis to Pittsburgh. And so I could definitely see, if he's still there and no one's been drafted yet at that position, which I think there's a distinct possibility that we get to Steelers pick at 20 and there's no quarterbacks taken. Like, that could be something that happens. And so the question then becomes, right, is a team then going to trade up and grab Willis before the Steelers? I think that situation could certainly happen. But again, it's which team is going to do that, right? Which team is going to, because when you trade up in the first round, you typically have to give up a pick, right? So you're trading away a pick next year's draft. So is there a quarterback that you feel that good about, that you feel so good about that you're willing to mortgage part of the future for that? I would say no. Now, next year, C.J. Stroud, Bryce Young, Will Levis, there's always someone else that they come. Like, I can see next year being the year where teams desperately try to trade up for one of those guys. I'm just not sure it's going to be this year.
Do you think that there's anybody on the defensive side? I know that Derek Stingley most likely going to be a top 10 pick, a huge opportunity with the secondary. Do you see a guy like that who can be like a lockdown corner or a really, really good safety that might be enough of a trade bait that somebody decides, hey, I want to try to go up and get him?
I mean, if there is a scenario where like Sauce or Stingley falls to like 11 or 12, I mean, I think Washington 11 would gladly take one of those two guys. You know, maybe I think it's probably, you know, if you go, you know, three defensive ends, three offensive linemen, a quarterback. I mean, I guess there's a possibility that one of those corners slips to 10 and the Jets at 10 either trade back or maybe at 11. But again, like Washington, I think at 11, though, would gladly take a corner. So I don't know if Washington would part with that, with those capital, you know, and take some later picks. So maybe that, I mean, maybe if Kayvon Thibodeau drops past 7 with the Giants, Atlanta at 8, I think we'll be willing to get more draft picks and someone trades up for Kayvon. I think that he doesn't get past Seattle at 9 if he's still there. But I just, we'll have to see how it unfolds. I really don't think we're going to get, again, I think we're pretty much going to stay pretty chalky in the first 10 picks. Like it's probably going to be between 10 and 12 guys for those 10 picks.
So Jeff, the first round, obviously a lot of excitement. Everybody loves to talk about it and, you know, the potential for some trades or just can't believe that they, you know, made the decision to, you know, talking about like the Bears a few years ago with Mitch Trubisky, like these decisions that sometimes seem just totally irrational. But looking at your own personal experience, you know, you were a 7th round pick, turned it into a 7 season active NFL career. You know, your brother Mitchell was a 2nd round pick, had a long career in the NFL, very successful. Do you have any, based off of those personal experiences, thoughts on, you know, what players that are drafted in later rounds are thinking or going through, and then how they can transition that into a lengthy NFL career that sometimes outlasts some of these high draft picks going forward?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, if you're drafted in rounds 1 through 4, maybe 5, I mean, you're pretty much guaranteed a roster spot in your first year. You know, the lower you get down, the less likely that is. And I will say that, you know, when I was drafted in 2008, it was almost unheard of to cut a draft pick, like even a 7th round draft pick. Now, I mean, these GMs don't care. Well, 7th round pick, I mean, you're the Chiefs, you have 12 draft picks, right? If you draft all 12, you're gonna end up cutting 3 of those draft picks or 4 of them, right? It's just not just roster wise. You can't keep all those guys. So I'll just say this, man, like the guys that are drafted later, 6th, 7th round, undrafted free agent guys, every rep you take has to count because you're not going to get a lot of them. And in the reps that you do get, if you screw up, they're not putting you back in, right? Coaches, if I'm an offensive line coach and I put Jeff Schwartz in and he doesn't know what he's doing, then I look bad. I look like I don't know how to coach that guy. I'm not putting him in the game. If I have you know, a corner, a wide receiver, a linebacker, and they have busted assignments all the time, then that looks bad on me. That means I can't coach him up. I'm not going to play him anymore. And so it's very important to when you get those opportunities, you have to play well, or at least make splash plays, right? Show promise, and where coaches are watching film and going, hey, man, wow, like that is I want Jeff Schwartz on my team, right? Like watch that play right there. Look at that potential. And really the first thing that goes into that is just knowing what you're doing. And it's knowing not only really what you're doing at times, but what everyone else is doing. Because the more confident you feel about what you're doing out there, the faster you play. The faster you play, you obviously make more plays. So it's important for those late round guys to really lock into their playbook and just spend extra time knowing everything to make yourself versatile. You know, the higher round guys typically are more talented, obviously, at least right off the bat. And so, you know, maybe there's not as much needed from them as far as knowing what you're doing, just going to make some plays. But that stuff eventually catches up to you. If you don't know what you're doing, you won't stay in the league for a while. But those guys just get more leeway. I mean, it bothered me my entire career to see players continually get onto rosters that were much worse than I was. But the reason they were on the roster was because they were a 2nd-round draft pick or a 7th-round pick. It carries through your entire career. It matters your entire career where you were drafted. And so, you know, that's the challenge that these draft picks have later in the draft is limited opportunities. And if you don't succeed in those opportunities, again, that are limited, you're not going to get more. The coaches are just not going to put you in.
Jeff,
so kind of
go on. I'm sorry.
Kind of piggybacking off of that, you know, it seems like you're really focusing on for those lower draft picks that, you know, really technique matters, getting the little things right, showing that you've got the training and the experience to do the little things right, and you can make up for some of that athleticism in that way. As a former lineman, you know, we hear you can't coach size, and that's a mantra that's been around for a long, long time. Do you think that sometimes coaches, and especially like the NFL scouts and staffs, do you think they tend to overrate or underrate that natural physical attributes like size? You know, especially like even outside of linemen, QBs, for instance, we've seen guys that get drafted high because they're, you know, prototypical NFL QB size and things like that, and maybe some other talented QBs get overlooked because they're on the shorter side.
Well, I certainly believe that, you know, the body size and ideal body structure. I mean, there's plenty of data that, you know, a 6'3 quarterback, 6'6, you know, 6'5, you know, is kind of going to just be better than someone who's 5'11 or someone even really. I mean, Justin Herbert is the first like huge tall quarterback to be really good. A lot of those guys end up being like too tall for some reason. Long releases, not very mobile. And so I think it matters. I think it matters size. I mean, you don't want an offensive tackle with small arms, short arms. You don't want a defensive lineman with short arms. You know, you love your corners to be long and lengthy. But in the end, the most important thing is the film. It's can they play? And I think that's where we don't put enough into that. Like my brother, for example. He was a four-time All-Pro in Kansas City. He won a Super Bowl. He was the best right tackle in the NFL for four seasons. His, like, combine scores are atrocious. Like, they are terrible. You go look at them. And, like, his thing was, like, can I block the person or not? Yes, I'm very good at that. Cool. Like, I think teams overlook that, right? Like, he could really block the person in front of him. And I think with offensive linemen, that's a big issue, is that you look at the size and the traits, and you're like, okay, well, that guy – you know, they can be good, but can they actually block anyone? You know, if you're a quarterback, like, are you accurate or not? I mean, size is important, sure, but are you accurate or not? Because if you're ideal size, but you're not accurate, you're probably not going to be very good in the NFL. Well, I'll end with this. And here's why I think it matters somewhat. I mentioned earlier, it matters somewhat. I mean, you know, a guy like Josh Allen, who was very inaccurate at Wyoming, he was very inaccurate his first year and a half in the NFL. And he's the outlier anyways for this discussion, but, you know, if you had a guy with less physical gifts, he's not becoming what Josh Allen is, right? So the rare guy that can do that, Josh Allen, makes everyone else think that they need to be or draft a Josh Allen size. I mean, that's kind of the way it works. So I think size does matter somewhat, but can you play football, man? Like, it's that simple. When you turn the film on, can you block? Can you tackle? Can you throw? Can you catch? Those, to me, far outweigh size and strength and how you look in the uniform.
Jeff, I wanted to catch back on to another previous comment that you had when you were talking about a guy who's drafted in a later round and has to prove his opportunity. And when he gets that opportunity, he's able to perform in front of a coach, make a coach look good, gets himself a roster spot, and gets himself with actual reps of quality. What was your moment as a late round draft pick that you realized, oh man, I got the opportunity and I nailed it?
Yeah, so it was my second season in the NFL. I was on practice squad my first year. In my second year, I dressed, and I play a little bit sparingly, special teams, some goal line tight end. And then our starting right tackle got hurt in the fourth to last game of the season. We were at New England. I played like three plays in a blowout, and that was it. And then we played the Vikings on Sunday Night Football next week, and I started a right tackle. And that was – Ray Edwards and Jared Allen, and then the Williams brothers, Pat and Kevin on the inside, some really good defensive linemen. And I played well. Like, and they helped me with a little bit of game plan stuff, but I came out of that like, okay, well, I can play. But here's the thing about the NFL. The NFL will humble you very quickly. And this is a thing that you learn as a young player, is that you can never take any game for granted or any opponent. And the next season, this is my now – we played Tampa. It was week two. Might have been week two. My fifth start down in the NFL, and we were playing like some, you know, defensive ends that were nobodies, and they weren't very good, and they weren't at least highly rated or touted. I remember all week the other offensive linemen were like razzing me, like, "Hey man, you have an easy week, blah 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 blah. You're gonna just, you know, I wish I could have your week." And then I played terrible, terrible game. You know, two sacks, bunch of penalties and pressures, and you learn. Like, every play is super important, and every play someone can beat you. And the second you take your opponent lightly, you will not last long in this league. And so that was, you know, again, I knew I could play in the NFL, but then you always have to have that lesson. I think everyone has that lesson at some point in their career of, you know, you just get a little cocky. Because in college, you can get away with that. Like, you can play. I was in the Pac-10. I mean, I could circle seven games a year where I could go 85% and play just fine, and we were going to blow the team out. You can't do that in the NFL.
So I just want to do a quick station identification, so to speak. You're listening to RCFB Talk 29. Our guest right now is Jeff Schwartz, former NFL offensive lineman, current commentator for both Fox Sports in the NFL, and has the Pac-12 show on, I think it's Pac-12 Today, on Sirius XM Radio, as well as other things. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But, you know, I wanted to bring in a couple of questions we had from readers on RCFB when we announced that this was coming. And one of them, and the one I wanted to lead off with, is from one of our longest-standing Oregon Ducks fans, Cambodian Drywall.
Okay.
I'll read what he wrote. "Hey, Jeff, I already know the fan perspective, but could I get your thoughts on the 2007 season? Unless, of course, the memories are too painful. If that's the case, my backup question is, what was your favorite college football game in which you played? Thanks and go Ducks." And before I let you answer, Jeff, I want to piggyback on that. I was in Austin when you guys beat USC, when I was a USC, already an alum, but I was that's when I scared me. I realized I'm older than you are. But when you guys beat the Trojans in Austin that year. But I just would love to hear your thoughts on 2007, because that was a wild one.
Were you one of the 33,000 strong on Saturday at the spring game, the sold-out spring game we were told that was going to be sold out? Were you one of those brave the LA weather? What?
You know, the Jeff, you might, I don't know, maybe you get this. I know you grew up in LA, but the longer you spend in a place with actual weather, the more you start to actually kind of get this weird sense of, I don't know, loathing might be the wrong word, but kind of bitterness towards the weaklings back in, you know, maybe San Diego or LA or wherever, and just like, you don't know what weather really is. You know, when they throw on,
yeah, that's why you live in Southern California.
It drops into, you know, the high 50s. But
I just wanted to make sure. I just had to get my USC dig in there. The greatest 4-8 team of all time. All right, so back to Oregon. 2007 was tough. So for those who don't know, that was, you know, Chip's first year. So Chip got there as an OC, and we started out fast. We went to Michigan. That was after we lost to App State. We blew them out, and we were rolling. We lost to Cal, and we fumbled out actually the back of the end zone going into tie that game, and we were 8-1, and Dennis hurt his leg, and that was it for us. But, you know, Dennis was winning the Heisman, and we were probably winning the championship. And I think that people say, oh, Oregon, but here's the difference, guys, between the 2010 team and the 2014 team. Both those teams were in the championship game. We had pro dudes everywhere. Like, that's the big difference. We had two NFL running backs. I think Jeremiah Johnson might still be in the CFL, but Jonathan Stewart played 11 years in the NFL. Dennis Dixon was going to win the Heisman. We know how good he was at. Ed Dixon was our tight end. He played 10 years in the NFL. I played 8. Max Unger, our center, played 10 or 11. Finucane Tupou, our left tackle, played a handful of years. Our right guard was bounced around, played arena ball for many years. We had four defensive backs playing the NFL. Pat Chung just retired. I mean, that's how long he played. Walter Thurman won a Super Bowl. T.J. Ward won a Super Bowl. Jerry Bird was a multiple-time All-Pro. Nick Reed was our defensive end. He was the leader in sacks and tackles for loss in the Pac-12 in 2007. Like, we had a really good team. And that doesn't count some wide receivers that we had that got hurt during the season that might have been draft picks for us. And so we were just really good. And we had an offense, Chip's first year, that no one was stopping. We, you know, you mentioned that USC game, you know, USC's defense had 11 guys all get drafted, and their backups got drafted, like in the fourth round. Thomas Williams, the linebacker, was a backup, fourth round draft pick. And we played really well against them. Like, we were good. We were good. And if you look at LSU that year or Ohio State, I forget which one we would have actually played in the title game, they just weren't as good as, like, LSU was 2 years ago, right? Or Ohio State has been in previous years. So I think we had a chance to win. We really did. So it's unfortunate.
Disappointing. You know, Jeff, I just have to say, I remember when Dennis Dixon went down with the knee the second time in Arizona. And that was just crushing. You could tell that Oregon team was a hunt. It was like, how do you recover from that? I agree with you. I thought he should still win the Heisman. Because, I mean, I think you should look at the guy's work while he was playing. I mean, he really was just an incredible QB. I mean, because I kind of become a conference fan when, you know, in those years when USC would finally, you know, they managed to lose, I'm like, well, okay, I guess it's going to be Oregon's turn this year. They look really great.
Yeah.
Chip Kelly's just taken off where Bellotti left, you know, kind of built up together. I thought it was going to be great. And then that injury, I'm still mad about that, the way that happened. Because I thought at least he should have been invited to New York. Because that was just, he was dynamite.
And what's crazy about that season, too, is, like, not only Dennis got hurt, we played the next weekend at UCLA. And so our Nate Costa was going to be our – basically, he was our third-string guy, but he was redshirting because he was young. And we were going to redshirt him, but he was, like, our emergency guy because he was more of a dual threat than we had. Brady Leaf, Ryan's brother, was the backup. And then Nate had torn his ACL 2 weeks before Dennis did, so he wasn't able to play. And then we had Brady Leaf – and Brady broke his foot the next week against UCLA. So we ended the UCLA game. We had 0 points. We didn't get inside the 35-yard line. We went from averaging like 40 points a game to zero. We ended that game with a Wildcat running back and a fourth-string walk-on freshman quarterback. And then we ended the season in the Sun Bowl with our fifth-string quarterback because our fourth-string got hurt against the Beavers. So we ended the year with a fifth-string walk-on quarterback. It was just it ended terribly. I mean, we won the Sun Bowl. It was a lot of fun being South Florida, but man, we were good. And like the pro talent is so different than the other teams. I mean, Darren Thompson was our quarterback in 2010. I mean, you know, that's wild that Oregon played a championship game and almost beat Auburn with a quarterback that, you know, couldn't barely play in the CFL.
Absolutely. You know, one other quick question that was asked in that by another Oregon fan, the Such. What's your favorite restaurant in Eugene?
Oh man, I haven't been to Eugene. Whew. The funny part is actually I'm in Oregon now. Hawaiian Time was always a favorite of mine. Probably when I was in school, Hawaiian Time was. I probably could never eat Hawaiian Time now. Like that would just wreck my digestive system. See, the older you get, it's so funny. I went back to Eugene. When I go back to Eugene, I took my son in to a game in 2019. And you know, I hadn't been back to Eugene in probably 11 years. It's just I live in Charlotte. It's a long way to get to Eugene. And it's so funny when you're older, like what you realize, like I noticed pharmacies and kids' playgrounds and schools and like little places to eat and things that like I would know because I'm with my kid. It was kind of funny. I just never knew those places even existed while I played because why would I ever have to go to a pharmacy? You just go in the training room. Why would I ever know where a playground was or a hospital or like I didn't know any of this stuff. It was really funny going back and noticing all different things about Eugene.
I love it. Hey, Ramsbeat, I know you wanted to ask a question of our guest.
Yeah, how's it going? Hey, I was just in a thanks a lot for letting me on. I just wanted to ask Jeff a question. So I just was actually in it's a big night for Twitter Spaces, just in a huge Jet space with Damian Woody and Michael Coe, and asked those guys this question. I just wanted to run it by you. So just with all the emergence of these superstars getting signed, I mean, obviously the Rams, you know, kind of led the way the last couple of years anyway with Stafford with two firsts, and then before that Ramsey and two firsts. And there's this, you know, now with Hill and Adams on the move for a first and second, these really top high-end superstars are starting to exert their kind of leverage in the league, in the NFL. And there's a narrative that it's starting to move more toward what the NBA has had, where the stars are getting more power. I just wanted to get your take on if you sense that around the league, that players are getting at least the top stars are getting more power, and how you see that evolving.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're getting more power. I mean, they're able to, you know, make a lot of noise and be able to be on the move. But, you know, the Rams are kind of the example of when it works, right? You had Jalen Ramsey and you had Matt Stafford. But Matt Stafford wasn't like a hostile thing, right? It was like, okay, it was time, new coach, new GM, it was time for him to go. You know, Von Miller was a late addition, obviously, last season as well. But, like, is Tyreek Hill in a better place now that he's in Miami? Is Davante Adams in a better place now that he's in Vegas? Like, it's okay to try to leave, but that doesn't mean you're in a better place, right? I mean, right, Tyreek Hill's not winning a championship in Miami. He's not going to be the same player he was. Davante Adams went from Aaron Rodgers. And I think Derek Carr is good, but he's in the toughest division in the NFL now. And so I'm all for player movement. I love it, man. Like, get paid and but I think that sometimes it's just not, the grass is not always greener elsewhere. And it worked out for the Rams, but that's really these dream team things don't work out unless you're Tom Brady. But Tom Brady basically went to a ready-made team and brought Gronk with him, right? It wasn't like there was a lot of wholesale additions to Tampa. But what the Rams did is very unique, and it worked. And I say that, you know, people say, well, how do they keep doing it? And part of it is they just, there's not a lot of depth, right? If there's a couple injuries for the Rams at some positions, that's it. They just, season's over. It is what it is. But they won last year, and it worked, and they should get credit for what they did last season.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And yeah, just on the Rams, I spent a lot of time on the pod and website talking about Rams team build, and they just, you know, really rely very heavily on those early contract guys, those rookie deal guys. And then the other thing that they really don't do is have a lot of mid-level guys, you know, signed between the, you know, sort of that $6 and $12 million range. It's like the lowest in the league by a mile. So just a different team build strategy, pay the big guys, get a lot of production, a lot of snaps out of the early contract guys. But hey, just a quick follow up though, just that's more relevant to, you know, to what's going on with Debo and that sort of thing is, so there's obviously this huge, you know, this explosion of the wide receiver market. And it seems like certain teams are feeling like, hey, there's this enormous number of great wide receivers. Like, we've never seen more wide receivers coming out ready to play, obviously with Chase and Jefferson and others, Waddle and this and that last year and, you know, a few the year before. And so, you know, we can replace guys. So there's this huge new, you know, early contract, inexpensive, superstar caliber wide receivers. And then other teams are feeling like, hey, we're going to pay heavy. We're going to trade first and second. So we're going to pay heavy for some superstars. And then even we signed some guys like Diggs. So do you have a take on which way you'd lean? And do you feel like you're more toward, hey, there's this up and coming class of wide receivers, I'd invest in the younger guys or would you, you know, pay the superstars?
Well, to me, you can only pay a wide receiver if you have your four other positions that are important locked down, right? Quarterback, left tackle, defensive end, or pass rusher, essentially, and cornerback, right? Like, to me, you can't pay a wide receiver unless you have those positions locked up. And it's really interesting that Kansas City and Green Bay – now, Davante Adams, Green Bay would have paid it, but he didn't want to be there. And, of course, you know, you can increase pay and whatnot to get a guy to stay. The Chiefs are like, yeah, we're just not paying you all that money anymore. You know, those are two teams that have done a lot of winning, and they've done winning at a high level for many years now. And if they're like, you know what, we're cool with Tyreek Hill, all right, buddy, we'll see you later. Like, that makes you think, like, maybe they know something we don't about wide receivers, right? Maybe, and they could be wrong, of course, but maybe, you know, you have MVS and you have Juju, and, you know, you get yourself Burks or Dotson in the first round, and you're set, Hardman and Travis Kelce, and you're set, you're good. That replaces one Tyreek Hill, ends up being three wide receivers on lower level deals. So just kind of, I think it all depends on where you are in your team building process. Like, I would not pay for Debo Samuel. Like, he's had 13 games essentially being the guy he is. Like, that to me feels way premature to give him a brand new contract when he hasn't even given you 16 games of what he is.
So, Jeff, we want to respect your time. I know you've been here for a while. We have other questions if you're able to stay, but we don't want to keep you here too long. We said,
I probably got about 5 minutes. You're going to throw some questions my way.
Well, then let me You know, I have a question, but at the same time, we always like to go to people who've taken the time to reach out. Andrew Thew, I just let you up. We'd love to hear from you. What's your question? Looks like they're having just make sure to unmute. yeah, sometimes we run into that issue. You know, actually, I do have a question for you. One of the other users on RCFB, Jackie Brown, you know, he wanted his question. I thought was a good question, especially someone in your position. What do you think the long-term outlook of the Pac-12 looks like right now? Do you think they go all in with one media company for the new media deal, like the SEC with ESPN, or do you think they split control of the Pac-12 network with their new media partner?
It's a good question. You know, I really like our new commissioner. I think he's done a lot of great things, and I think he so far the things he's done, the vision he's had. Is important. You know, the thing about, and I get it that he voted no for the CFB playoff expansion, even though he's been publicly in favor of it. But I think part of it was the TV rights issue, right? Where, you know, if the Pac-12 goes and partners with Fox or NBC or CBS and they don't have any playoff games, like how attractive is that partnership? Right? I think that, you know, being able to bid out those playoff games between the networks like they do in the NFL kind of makes everyone richer. And I think he saw that and just, he wants an expanded playoff, but just wants it to be where the Pac-12 was able to earn some more money on top of all that. And so, the Pac-12 network is important, you know, not so much on the football side, but it's really important to promote other sports in our conference. So I hope it stays and it's able to be picked up. Like I have DirecTV. I mean, I have the app. I watch Pac-12 network on the app or smart TV. But I just wish it was in more homes. As far as, look, the TV deal is going to be, I think, in my opinion, come down to really how good USC is in 3 or 4 years, which should be good, how good Oregon is. You know, can Washington with DeBoer kind of bounce back? What's UCLA going to be like with Chip in 3 or 4? Like, it's important to have our strongest brands be good. I have faith that Lincoln Riley will be good. I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't beat USC, but Dan Lanning, man, like, they're going hard. Like, they're gonna get themselves players. I think he can coach. So, the health of our conference and the football side will help drive a TV deal. Basketball side a little bit. I mean, the Bruins are good and Arizona's good, but I don't know how much that drives a TV deal. But to me, it's just finding a way to get money, because, you know, people, I think, look at and ask, you know, why that's so important. Well, it's about, right? It's about recruit. It's about being able to have a big recruiting staff. It's about being able to have the best facilities, things that you and I might not care about, but like these kids, man, they love these locker rooms. They love the perks. They love the amenities. They love the attention. And it's important to be able to have all those things at your disposal when you're recruiting athletes. Because, you know, college football, as much as it is about what happens on the field, it's about recruiting, right? You can't win in this sport unless you have a certain number of blue chip players. And so all of the money that you generate, you know, through TV deals helps you recruit. And the Pac-12 is behind in that. They know that. George Klopkov knows that, but it's important to be able to get more money to our schools.
One last question. We wanted to go to Adam because he's always been around. And Adam, wrap us up right now. What's our final question for Jeff tonight?
Hey, Jeff. Appreciate it. So I am a college football coach, and I actually am, you know, a West Coast guy originally. Now,
Oh no! Wait.
Living in the South.
Oh, Adam, we can really we lost you there.
You back? Oh no!
You know, hey, hey, Adam, you might. Well, fortunately, we've lost you there. You know, but you know, Juwan, I know you're also one of our regulars. Do you want to give us a quick question then for Jeff?
I was just kind of listening. What kind of were we going over? I just got out of an AAU basketball practice.
any football topic you want. What do you got for me?
Okay, this is one that just comes off the top of my head right here. In your eyes, do you believe that the star power matters? And do you think that NIL is affecting recruiting right now?
NIL is certainly affecting recruiting. And here's my take on NIL. I mean, good for the players. You know, good for them. And again, like, would I pay $8 million for a quarterback? No, but it's not my money. And good for Nico, right? Like, get that money if you can. Look, here's the thing about NIL is that it's brand new, right? It's not even been a year yet. And I think that at first there's going to be sticker shock on how much players are getting paid from these collectives. And it's not going to be the same in 3 or 4 years. It could be more, but I'm going to guess it's going to be less, right? You know, if you're giving a quarterback $8 million, yeah, you're expecting a championship, a Heisman. Is that going to happen in Tennessee? I mean, our Vols fans out here, probably not, right? And, like, so you're going to pay the next quarterback $8 million? Probably not, right? Like, I think that it's sticker shock. It's a lot of money. It feels big, and it is. It's very important, I think, for these players to get as much as they can. But, you know, A&M has a top 10 class every year. Now they're just number one, right? I mean, like, Oregon's had a top 10 class. USC has had great classes under Clay Helton, believe it or not. They're going to have a good class again this year. Like, the schools are staying the same that are at the top. It's just a matter of now, you know, are these collectives going to want to pay a lot of money for non-championships? Like, are they going to want to pay all this money to have Alabama and Clemson and Ohio State, you know, keep winning all those championships? So that's my question. And we're not going to have an answer for 3 or 4 years. So, yeah, it's a lot of money. It is. But it's not my money. And for so many years, players were not getting compensated. So good for them. I'm glad they're getting their money. And let's not pretend this wasn't already happening, right? But now I think it's a matter of what is this in 2 or 3 years or 4 years? I don't think players will get the same amount of compensation from this collective as they are getting now, because I think the money is not going to produce wins as expected.
Well, thanks again, everyone who's listening. Jeff, thank you for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me
on.
Really
appreciate
you
taking the time and hearing your thoughts on the draft.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Have a good
day,
everybody.
And so, yeah. And, hey, everyone, this is RCFB Talk 29. We're going to go ahead and wrap it up now that our guest is over. And we just wanted to thank all of you for listening. Sorry about that. Adam, we know you tried to ask a question. We couldn't hear anything that was coming at the end. So, next time. But for all of you, for all of us here, thank you. We'll be doing our normal talk again next Tuesday night. And have a great week, everyone.